Welcome to Recovery Radio by Landmark Recovery with your host, Zach Crouch. In this program, we'll discuss the root causes and treatments of alcohol and substance addiction, speak with experts in related fields, and help navigate the road to recovery. Now, here's the host of Recovery Radio, Zach Crouch.
Hi, I'm Zach Crouch, and you're listening to Landmark Recovery Radio, your source for addiction and recovery news and knowledge. You can find us online wherever you get your podcasts, so don't forget to subscribe to get the most up-to-date information from leading experts. We have guest Dr. Lori Leigh Bellhumer joining us on the show today. Dr. Leigh Bellhumer is a licensed psychologist serving as CEO at Western Youth Services for over 19 years now. She received her PhD and MA degrees from UCLA. Western Youth Services annually provides integrated mental health services to over 50,000 clients, both directly and indirectly. Lori has led the charge that reexamines mental health in the context of adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, and offers solutions that not only treat the predictable negative impact of ACEs, but that look upstream to prevent them from happening in the first place. Dr. Leigh Bellhumer, it is a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to getting into this discussion.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here, and I look forward to our discussion.
Me too. Share with us a bit about yourself. How did you come to be interested in addiction recovery as well as mental health issues for youth?
Well, it's funny because I think maybe you and some of your audience members can agree that many of us who gravitate toward this profession, whether it's addiction recovery or in the mental health, behavioral health field, we sort of gravitate toward it to maybe heal ourselves in a way. I used to refer to my life as a series of adversities, and it was happy most of the time. But always, just always knew at the bottom of my heart, even as a young child, that I was put here to help people. And I initially went into college as a nursing major. This is, I'm aging myself, but, back then we went, women were either nurses or teachers. So I gravitated toward nursing, but really bombed at science. So I was redirected to the field of psychology, and knew once I made that decision that I was getting a PhD, and that I was going to be a psychologist, and that's the trajectory of my life. So that's how I went into the profession. I also knew at some point that it was really working with children, because I think that the children definitely are our future. That's an adage, if you will. But it is the truth. And if we can go in and help bolster the minds and hearts of kids to know their true value, and know what their strengths are and their superhero talents, and really tap into those things, then give them, support and hope for a better future in the face of adversity. So that's how I got here, and that's why I do what I do.
I love it. And as you were talking, I was thinking about some questions, as you were explaining in the beginning when I asked that question, a lot of the people in this field get into it because they're really searching to make sense, I think, of the experience or experiences that they've had. Does that still ring true today? You've been in this field for quite a while, that there's still a mystery in some respects.
Well, it's very interesting, and anybody who knows me also knows that I love data, like love data. Mm-hmm. So I make sense of these things by really looking at what does the research say? What is the data out there? And so I stumbled upon something, and I know we're going to talk about adverse childhood experiences in the study a little bit later, but one of the things, I became trained as a master trainer by ACE Interface, so Adverse Childhood Experiences Interface, which is a resource from the original researchers of the ACE study back from 1998. So a few of us were trained as master trainers here at Western Youth Services. And so we were giving these presentations about the ACE science and about the ACE study and all of that. And our audience was, typically teachers, counselors, other youth serving individuals who wanted to know more about the adverse childhood study, like the science behind it and the connection between, the trajectory of the negative impacts of adversity with children. And so one of the things that we found was we gave an ACE screening. So we had these 10 original ACEs. And again, we can talk, specifically about those, what those are. But we had done some studies with kids that had mental health diagnoses. And we looked at the prevalence of ACEs in their lives if we did the screener. And then we did the ACEs screening with these audiences of teachers and professionals and youth serving individuals. And what we found is that the number of ACEs, the number of that they endorsed of having, exposure to predict, these particular adverse childhood experiences, the number that the people in the room had mirrored the number that kids with mental health diagnoses had. So in other words, they mirrored kids with adversity that had mental health diagnoses as opposed to mirroring, say, the general population. And so So
they were getting,
it was just like really solidified. Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. So those of us who've experienced, this adversity, we gravitate toward, youth serving roles because I think we're trying to figure it out. But we also have what I think really is a moral imperative to make an impact in the lives of kids to give them a better future because, we're resilient, we're the ones who sort of we're in these professions. And so we've demonstrated that there's something that we have that allowed us to overcome and be victorious over adversity. So we want to pass that down to the next generation. That's what I believe.
I'm going to back up just briefly because I think that, most of the people in our field know what the ACE study involved. But can you just briefly explain what the Adverse Childhood Experience Study was? And more importantly, why is it the bedrock, you think, for understanding, we'll just say folks, even adults today, because, this is a long-term study, still have problems, both right. Medical and mental health in their lives.
Right. So the original study dates back to 1998, and doctors Folletti and Anda were measuring things like obesity, I think, originally, or some other health problems. And they started to ask questions specifically related to before the age of 18, were you exposed to, and there were 10 different categories, questions that fell into 10 different categories. Abuse, physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, physical or emotional neglect, so abuse, neglect, and then categories of family dysfunction in the household, including parents or caregivers that were misusing alcohol or drugs, domestic violence, incarceration, a parent was incarcerated or a parent had mental illness. So those were the original 10. And then what they found as they, which was really made what made it the landmark study, is that they looked at the health, mental health, and other conditions, and they saw that the the higher the number of exposure to these ACEs, every single condition, obesity, diabetes, smoking, heart disease, lung disease, cancer, depression, anxiety, PTSD, they all went up in stepwise fashion. So I'm using my hands as I'm talking. So, you know, if you had one, if you had two, they all went up in stepwise fashion, so that the higher the exposure to the number of adversities, the higher the risk, the higher the percentage of likelihood that you would have these conditions in adulthood when left untreated. So I just want to make sure that I put that in there, because there's hope, you know, because when there is treatment early on, we can change the trajectory. But, you know, that was what it was. And if you look at the original study, there's, you know, just all of them. And it just, it literally made the original researchers weep when they saw it, because why was nobody paying attention to this? And that's why it really, when we draw attention to it, it's really a public health crisis. And it's something that we can do something about when we're looking what's now called upstream. You know, we're looking at the things that, you know, are attributable to these social determinants of health. You know, we're looking at, what are these social determinants of health? Let me, you know, say, like, what are the things that are, that where we can predict a higher risk of health, mental health, and addiction problems? So that's sort of why it's a landmark study. And I'm not sure I answered the second part of your question.
No, I think that was great. I was curious as well, kind of along those same lines, in the data that you're collecting and in reviewing, have you found at all any evidence that, you know, one subset of abuse, you know, within that 10 categories can be more impactful than the other, you know, or is it more important to take into account the total number of ACEs a person has versus these sort of aggregate scores?
You know, that is a really, really great question, because first of all, let me say, if the likelihood of having, if you have one, there's a higher likelihood that you have more than one. So,
that's right.
So it's like accumulate, you know, so there's definitely, you know, they occur together in some cases. But let me, I would be remiss if I didn't mention this particular thing, that, you know, the original ACE study was, you know, some time ago. There's a ton of research with the original ACEs. And then recently, you know, under the great leadership of Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, who did a TED Talk a while ago on ACEs. If you haven't watched it, you should definitely take a look at it. And it really explains the study. And she's just really the trailblazer for highlighting it as a public health crisis recently, or at least in the last decade. And so here in the state of California, she's added related life events to the screener and mandated screening for kids in the state of California. So it's the original 10 and then 7 related life events. And so it is, you know, whether there's food insecurity and housing instability, if there's neighborhood or community violence, bullying, discrimination, institutional racism, or a caregiver's serious physical illness or death. So now there's 17 as opposed to the original 10. So there's 10 and then there's these other 7. But the interesting thing is that it's not that one is any worse than the other in terms of what exposure to adversity does on the developing brain, if that makes sense. So it's really the toxic stress response that is the predictor of the health issues. So the original study, interestingly, said no, one versus another isn't worse than, you know, so a particular kind of abuse is not any more or less stressful on the body or brain than than a parent's divorce. And remember back, you know, 1998, mm-hmm. these were adults who were asked if their parents divorced. And so in their timeline, you know, in their life, divorce was something that was very stressful. Not that it isn't now, but it was really, you know, if they were an adult in 1998, that means that their parents were getting divorced in the, you know, maybe the 60s and 70s when it wasn't as common, you know. And so it was a stressful, more stressful event. So I just want to make clear that it's really the exposure to the repeated exposure to the toxic stress, you know, over a period of time. So it could be even one of the, you know, one of the adversities, if it's repeated over consistently over a period of time, it's having this toxic stress response, you know, to the developing brain. And so, you know, we have to be careful when we say whether it's one versus four or whatever. It's really that, you know, that toxic stress response, which you and I were talking about, sure. you know, earlier, that it's, you know, it's that this fight or flight, you know, that happens and they're not able to kind of shut it off. And so they're living in a state of, you know, fear and hyper, you know, sensitivity and hyper alertness all the time. And that is what is, you know, the stress on the body that when it goes untreated can result in, you know, some, again, these serious sure. health and mental health problems.
So this is this concept of resilience. Okay, because it's been talked about a lot, and I'm curious because you're knee deep in the data and in the study of ACEs. What's your feedback or you know kind of conclusion on why some kiddos have better outcomes and why is one kiddo, you know, able to develop this resilience versus others who maybe just they don't have that capacity, you know, the capacity to deal with the toxic stress that we've been talking about. Is resilience even measurable?
Oh, that's such a great question. And it really is. I mean, you know, when you think about all of the factors that can be sort of subsets of resilience. So you might not measure resilience specifically, you know, but you'd sure. say, you know, social, emotional support and hope is a category that when provided results in, you know, a higher level of resilience. So interestingly, in the ACE interface sort of literature and all of that we were trained in, there are some specific categories. I'm so glad you asked this question because there are some specific categories where the research shows that when people who have been exposed to ACEs have these resources available in these four categories versus those that don't, there's a significant difference in their resilience. And so if you'll allow me, I'll just kind of go through the four categories and give some examples and also just share like the level. Okay, great. So the first one I just mentioned is feeling social, emotional support, and hope. So if you think about those kids, so what that means is that there are people it could be a teacher, it could be a parent, it could be a grandparent, where there's somebody who is in the life really providing emotional support and hope. For me, I know I go back and I know exactly my second grade teacher, you know, yeah. she was like the one, like I, you know, I could have been one of those kids who really got in trouble in class because I was like, I would yak it up, you know, I'd get finished first and then I'd start disrupting the class, right? So she's like, will you be my helper? Will you go pick up the paper, you know? So she really provided a level of, you know, emotional support to who I was. I mentioned this in the beginning, like who we are individually as children, what our strengths are, build on those strengths. And that is sort of the beginning of the resilience, right? So when we have that social emotional and hope for a better future, and whoever provides that. So when kids actually, or adults, if you ask them, you know, later in life, you know, did you feel that you had someone, you know, who was providing social and emotional support and hope, the risks of mental health, like say people with 4 to 8 ACEs are, you know, 40 times more likely to have mental health problems. But when they have emotional support and hope, the risk is dropped down to 10%. So there's a 30% improvement in resilience when they have emotional support and hope. It's just like, so that's one of the keys. The second,
and hope is not one of those tangible things. It's very, you know, it's just, it's there or it's not, you know. I think with most people, they would say that.
Well, right. And I think that when you have social and emotional support, that sort of inherently gives you hope for a better future. You know what I mean? Like, you know that there's somebody who cares about you, who, you know, who loves you and supports you for who you are. And what goes along with that is, you know, somebody there's hope for, like, you're looking up to somebody else, like a mentor or something like that. There's hope for a better future that's kind of like communicated through those people that are around that provide that social and emotional support. The second category is literally having some practical help, having two or more people who provide practical help. So that might be, for the adults, that might be, you know, somebody who, you know, drops off some groceries or goes, you know, it's just like, you know, the category of practical help is different than social and emotional, right? Yeah. That kind of thing. Yes, exactly. And so when it comes to providing help, again, you know, for those that are experiencing, you know, I'm going to say hunger insecurity or food insecurity, they're, you know, if you have 4 to 8 ACEs, you're 40% you know, more likely to have food insecurity. But when you're provided that practical help, it drops down to 10%. Depression, if you have no practical help, you're 14% more likely to be depressed. But if you get practical help, it drops down to 2%. So again, it's just like these dramatic increases in resilience. It's kind of going the opposite in the way that I'm describing it. The risk drops down. The risk of depression drops when you have access to practical help. And then the third, you kind of mentioned, you know, picking up the kids, but the third is community reciprocity. So I know, so what that means is like having a community where you kind of do things for each other. I know a group of single moms and they're together, like they just support each other. They pick up the kids for each other, but it's a reciprocal. It's, you know, there's just like, it's not like you're keeping track of like, I do this for you and you do this for me, but there's like a community of that community reciprocity. And again, just the research just shows that, you know, when you have that, it's, you know, it decreases the risk of these things. And then the fourth is social bridging. And that's really like, what are the kind of the end of the social support system and where you need to seek help outside? You know, so do you have a primary care doctor? Do you, you know, have a place where you can go get mental health services? Do you have a place where you can get addiction services? And when you have access to those things. So literally when you have the community reciprocity and the social bridging, it just dramatically increases things that are measured like, you know, happiness and physical activity and literally alcohol misuse decreases when you have those last two things. You know, they're you know, other social or other health problems are also positively impacted when you have social reciprocity and social bridging, you know, getting access to those resources outside of the social system. So those are really, you know, when we talk about resilience, those are four resilient factors that make a difference. And so there's lots of different things in each one of those categories that can count as that, if you will. And so it's just, you know, so there you go. Yes, there's research out there that shows what resilience is and what actually helps.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, you know, I want to kind of come back to, you know, a lot of people who get into this field are, you know, trained in a certain program, you know, to become, whether it's a, you know, a psychologist, a marriage and family therapist, which is what I am, or a counselor or whatever. And I don't know if this has been your experience, but when I went through my training, I did not receive a whole lot of training on understanding trauma. Okay. And it wasn't that long ago. It was, you know, coming up on 15 years or so ago now, but why is that? You know, have you found that to be true, especially for people who were trained back in, I would say, you know, the 80s, 90s, early 2000s even? Was it because the ACE study, you know, had not really been understood at that point and the aftermath of it?
Well, I think that, well, first of all, I graduated way before you did, and I didn't know about the ACE study. Like, I didn't, you know, that it occurred. I heard about it probably, you know, 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think that the whole, and I have been running the organization, this organization, Western Youth Services, for almost 20 years. And I can say that the concept of trauma-informed care is something that emerged over the past couple of decades. What I can say is that as therapists, we intuitively know that kids that have been exposed to trauma, you know, are more likely to have mental health problems. I mean, I think that we knew that. It's like when you start talking about the ACE study, it kind of provides a language, if you will, that everybody kind of translates the language of needing to be trauma, to be trauma informed. And so I would say, yes, there have been research and all kinds of stuff that over the years sort of continues. And I'm going to take a wild guess, like maybe in the last 10 years that some of the evidence-based treatment specifically identified as being, for trauma, you know, kind of became infused into, became more mainstream. That's a good way of putting it. I think that definitely there have been experts for decades in the area of trauma and being trauma informed and what trauma does to the developing brain and things of that nature.
Just briefly, I throw my little body keeps a score plug in here too, because that is, it was, and continues to be, as I've read it a couple of times now, the book that transformed my life in understanding trauma at a very different kind of level, by Bessel van der Kolk. His work has, I think, been instrumental in the field in helping people, really, who are not even professional, but lay people who read that, and they're just like, oh my God, I finally get it now, you know?
Yes.
So, anyway, I had to say that. So.
No, that's definitely true. And, groundbreaking, really.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit more just about how ACEs impacts the likelihood that an individual will experience substance use problems in their life.
Well, I think if I understand you correctly, it's kind of like, what is that trajectory from ACEs to, you know, adult life?
And how it becomes, so to speak, the coping mechanism that most people, or a lot of people, use when they have a tremendous amount of ACEs in their life.
Well, let's look at it this way. So I mentioned that when we have long-term exposure to adversity, it really impacts the developing brain. And so there are, so there's a tendency, because of the way the brain is developed sort of sequentially when they're younger, when, during the, young ages. I'm trying to really say mm-hmm. it to the sort of the massive population as opposed to using scientific terms here. So I'm stumbling a little bit.
I'll translate it if you get too far down.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
So in the developing brain, so we talk about, so they become hypersensitive, hyper aroused, hyper triggered. Like what that means is like, in the way it might manifest itself is like being like startled, really easily, or being, appearing to have attention problems, concentration problems, kind of living in a state of fear, like fight or flight. And so it's kind of like there's a documentary called Paper Tigers, and it talks about ACEs and how kids that are exposed to high levels of adversity and the toxic stress response don't know the difference between a real tiger and a paper tiger, mm-hmm. Because it just everything is scary. So if you think about going through life like you're trying to cross a freeway where cars are coming at you, in every direction, you think that you're, trying to do that, and you're going through life like that. And so it makes sense that people who are experiencing that would want to numb it. They would want to buffer it. They would want to calm themselves down in whatever way they can, sure. And
yes,
some people choose work, some people choose drugs, some people choose alcohol, some people choose sex, some people choose, all other kinds of things to sort of, mm-hmm. release that, energy and numb those, the fear response, right? So it's like a normal reaction to an abnormal set of circumstances. And so again, the hope is, and what we know now is that we can literally rewire the brain, mm-hmm. And reduce that toxic stress response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That it's not some sort of like death sentence, if you've been through a tremendous amount of these adverse childhood experiences, there is a lot of hope.
Exactly. There's a lot of hope there. And definitely those of us who are a little bit older used to be taught that, once you lost a brain cell, it was gone forever. So if you were doing things.
I think Nancy Reagan had us convinced of that through the DARE program. She didn't mean
it. Yes. Right. And so now we know that the brain has neuroplasticity and that it actually can, be rewired, and we can think differently and we can behave differently, and it literally changes how we view the world, and we can heal ourselves, obviously with help, we can heal ourselves from the impact of adverse childhood experiences on the brain.
Well, you've been doing this a long time. I mean, you've been working with youth for over 30 years now. Mm-hmm. Today with this wealth of experience and knowledge, what can be done for kids who experience these, adverse effects to really help them?
Well, I think it definitely want to refer back to the help that helps, those four categories of building resilience. Mm-hmm. And I'll just kind of really focus on the first one, which is providing emotional support and help. So I think that, what we know is having a caring, dependable adult who mm-hmm. believes in you, whether it's a child or your inner child, literally can be that person for a child to give them to give them hope for a better future. And it doesn't matter if you're a parent or a teacher or a counselor, you know, even one interaction, seriously, you can know that even one interaction can make a huge difference and change the trajectory of the life of a child. So it is, you know, so it's really, you know, you hone in, I mean, again, this might be really simplistic, but you hone in on the strength and really build it up. And so if you notice that, a boy or girl is being a little bossy, mm-hmm. for instance, they're a leader. You know, give them something to be in charge of, you know, so it's like, look at the individual strengths of a child, because you're asking, you know, what can we do? And I'm not talking to the therapist here. I'm talking just to, you know, any adult who has a child in their lives. This is what you can do for kids who've experienced adversity. And every child right now in the world has experienced adversity. Every single one of us, sure. With COVID and all of the civil unrest and everything that's going on in the world, you know, they've been exposed to trauma right now. And so what we can do is just really see that strength in them and reframe it into, you know, that this is, you know, this is who they are, and just love on them and nurture that strength. See the things, catch them doing things right, you know, honor the things that they're doing right and who they are, you know, as an individual, as opposed to saying, oh, good girl, good boy. No, it's, gosh, when you did that thing right there, when you did that kind gesture toward your little sister, that was beautiful. That was a beautiful thing, you know. And so it's really like pour the love and nurture into their hearts. That's what you can do with kids.
It sounds like being very intentional about what you say, right?
Yes.
I think that would be something that parents can really, you know, it's about noticing and then being intentional specifically about certain things that they're doing, doing well.
Yes, you're absolutely right there. You know, be intentional with your words. Words have power. You know, what you speak into a child becomes what they perceive about themselves. It really does. Like the words, you know, get repeated. So, you know, they're going to remember regardless of how, whatever the words are, they're going to remember, and it's going to become sort of the tape that they play in their little brains, you know, with their identity, you know? And so be intentional about, you know, what we say to children, especially as it relates to their behavior, but certainly about, you know, who they are as children. Again, this goes back to like any time there's an I am statement, that is the thing that we tell ourselves about who we are. So, you know, kids get a bad grade on a test and they start saying, I'm stupid. And then they find things in the world that make that consistent, and then they start to believe that about themselves. And so,
you can reframe
like this.
I was thinking about, so, you know, I don't think it's any surprise, but kids, you know, our children, my children, are often, most of the time, probably always, a reflection of both me and Emily, my wife's sort of attributes, you know, our personalities. And if we acknowledge in sort of, as I mentioned, I have a bit of a bossy daughter, I love her to death, but, you know, she's probably mirroring for me and her attributes, you know, when we start to notice them, at least things within ourselves, right, that we could probably nurture even more ourselves too, which gets the cycle of like just positive reinforcement going for both the kid and the parents. Like, you know what?
Well,
boy, I'm just that way too. You know, why is it that I try to deny or repress that piece, you know, the leader, whatever it is that is within parents, myself, whoever it is, you know, because there's real golden opportunity there.
Well, I think you just hit the nail on the head with something else, is that we as parents, we as influence leaders of youth, regardless of whether we're in the in a, you know, a youth serving profession, or, you know, we do have an obligation to kind of heal ourselves first, because kids are watching. They absolutely are. And they do mirror, they mirror us. So if they see us doing things that really are behaviors that, I'm going to really go here. If we're doing things that really look like we're not loving ourselves, we're not taking care of ourselves, we're not taking care of our partners or our significant others, our spouses, if we're treating, you know, ourselves and others with a lack of respect, and kids see that, you know, they're emulating. They are. They're little mirrors. And if we see it in the kids, the first thing we can do is like, oh, not that we're causing it, but am I mirroring that? Am I role modeling, you know, something that's kind of emerging here? Because it doesn't always, it's not always the parents. I don't want to say that. I absolutely don't want to do anything that gives parents, like, we're all doing the best that we possibly can given our own upbringings, right? But to be aware, to be intentional about how we treat others and also how we treat ourselves. I guess that's the point I'm making.
Fantastic. It has been a wonderful conversation, Dr. Lake, for us today and for our audience. I really do appreciate you coming on. This has been, we could talk for hours about this stuff.
I know.
This has been fantastic.
No, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity. As you can tell, anytime I have the chance to talk about building up kids or, you know, something that I know a little bit about with the ACEs study, I can go on and on. You're right, we could. But it's been an honor and a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation. And I look forward to potentially having another conversation, a continued conversation in the
Perfect.
Future.
Appreciate that.
Yeah.
I always have to say at the end here, listen, if you know someone struggling who, you know, has an addiction, a substance use problem, and you're searching for answers, visit us at landmarkrecovery.com to learn more about substance abuse programs that are both saving lives and empowering families. And until next week, I'm Zach Crouch with Landmark Recovery Radio. We have guest Melissa Atlas joining us on the show today. Melissa is the clinical supervisor at Franciscan Outpatient Behavioral Health in Indiana. She's also a contractor for the Indiana Credentialing Association on Alcohol and Drug Abuse. She's an LCSW, LCAC, and medication-assisted treatment specialist. She has more than 13 years of clinical experience. Melissa, it's a pleasure to have you on. Welcome to Recovery Radio.
I am excited to be here. Thank you, Zach.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and how did you get involved in this field of addiction treatment recovery?
Well, I went to college for something super useful and got a bachelor's degree in English literature.
Mm.
Yeah.
Nice.
And yeah, not at all practical, but it was a lot of fun.
You read a lot of books. Yeah.
I read a lot of books, a lot of Jane Austen, a lot of Chaucer in Old English.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was a senior in college, and the week of September 11th, my mom got sober.
Okay.
In 2001, and when I came home from graduating, she was sort of in the middle of being a newbie in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous programs, and and I was sort of directionless, and so she spoke up at a meeting and said that her kid needed a job, and someone who worked at a local inpatient facility said, well, I got a job for her, so I wound up working as a tech, and even at that time, I sort of knew I wanted to be in the helping professions, but really didn't know how to do that with a bachelor's in English. And sort of found my way working to folks who are in early recovery, and it just seemed to click. And a few years later, I got my master's degree, and here I am.
Was the, was the entrance of your mom at that point into the recovery process, sort of an impetus for you to pursue this particular field of mental health? Did that play a big part?
It absolutely did, and I'm sure that if she listens to this, she's going to love that I gave her credit for my career. But it, you know, I think
she'll be proud of that.
She'll be very proud of that.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
But also, I think that, you know, my mom was an active addiction for much of my adolescence and childhood, and I still loved her. You know, and so being
sure.
able to be with someone who is dealing with this monster of addiction and still see the humanity and the dignity and the struggle and learn how to, you know, not take the lies personally mm-hmm. definitely helped me find a level of compassion that is sometimes hard for people who don't have that personal experience when working with folks who are struggling.
Has your, I mean, when I say your background here, the question really is about your upbringing. And obviously being trained professionally is going to help a lot, but did your background growing up with your mom like that provide you sort of the vocabulary now to be able to understand better other people's experiences?
It really did. You know, I think I go back to that word of just dignity to think about things, because I knew my mom had a tough life growing up, and she would talk to me about, you know, when I was little, and she would ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up. You know, I was going to be a race car driver and president and all that cool stuff.
From Indiana, and that makes sense. Yeah,
absolutely. And when I would ask her, well, when you were little, what did you want to be? And she said, all I wanted to be was a wife and a mom. And to have that be her life's ambition and to be really good at it, and then to just have her whole identity be eclipsed by a substance is really mm-hmm. hard to watch. And to know that that person is still in there mm-hmm. while they're going through that. And so those, you know, it sort of gave me that understanding of you got to wait for the miracle, as I say in the program, and you got to be patient through that and keep showing up for them and in a boundaried way and take good care of yourself. Mm-hmm. And those skills have served me well in my career.
That is an interesting word that you brought up about the dignity piece. What does that mean to you? You know, in light of, you know, the heartache and I'd say the pain that people put themselves through, and often what I mean by that is not by choice. You know, they often find themselves in that process of not having a choice. But what does that word mean to you in light of everything that you, you know, maybe help people get through and families even? Has that word meant something even more to you now and continues to mean more to you now?
Yeah, I think that when somebody is in the middle of addiction and they're actively using, they are one of the most stigmatized populations in our country. You know, we think of people as junkies and addicts and drunks and all those other horrible things that get thrown at you. And when someone knows you struggle, they hold on to their purse a little tighter, or they change their expectations of you. And it's and there are reasons for that, to be sure. But at the same time, if they could control it, they'd be controlling it. It's and so there is still a human being who loves and who laughs and who cries and who struggles. And their minds have been, you know, taken over momentarily by something that wants to kill them. And if that's not horrifying, I don't know what is. And in light of the current opioid crisis, you know, most of my clients, regardless of how old they are dealing with just epic amounts of loss right now, where they've lost family members, friends, childhood friends, acquaintances to overdoses. And they're not even sometimes given permission to grieve that in their own families, because it was just another addict who died, you know, is how they kind of feel about it or talk to about it. And you know, it's still a person. It's still somebody who added something to this world who isn't with us anymore. And that heartbreak deserves to be honored. And sometimes just sharing that with somebody while they're, you know, just coming in, helps them feel human, helps them feel seen, and gives them a little bit of hope that, you know, I am still a person and I can do this.
Absolutely. I think that's beautifully said. I want to talk, as I mentioned in the introduction there, you know, you're a medication assisted treatment specialist, right? And, you know, that obviously tells me that you believe very highly in that particular approach to treating substance use problems. What's been your experience with medication assisted treatment in the field of recovery thus far?
So when I first started in the industry, as I mentioned, I was actually living closer to Chicago, and it was the early 2000s. So they were still dealing with the crack epidemic up there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I came off of reading Chaucer and was handed a bunch of SAMHSA documents to read to figure out how to be a counselor.
Those two go together.
Right. Yeah, not so much. And, you know, so in the literature, even then, you know, it would talk about methadone as just this, you know, this key, and it has these enormous success rates of folks who are dealing with opioid withdrawal and recovery and maintenance. And they would talk about how, you know, it's one of the more empirically bolstered interventions that we have for substance use disorders. And so I remember going to my boss at the time. I was like, hey, so do we do this methadone thing? And he's like, nah, that's trading one drug for another. And as a new clinician, I was like, oh, cool. So I just closed that. That's the last thing I have to study.
Right.
Yeah. And so it was, you know, very much an abstinence background, and then went to graduate school, came out, wound up in another abstinence-based program. And kind of, you know, that was how it was in my mind. They trade one drug for another. That's all I need to know about it. And that doesn't make sense. And then Suboxone came on the scene, you know, the buprenorphine.
Which would have been about when? When did it, in your sort of purview, come really rushing forward as a viable treatment?
Yeah, so that would have been in Indiana anyway, in like 2007 when I started really hearing about it consistently as an option for folks with opioid dependence. And I know it's been around longer than that, but it started to, you know, gain some traction. And that corresponds, of course, with the major upswing in opioid use disorder developing out of the overprescription of opioid pain relievers. And so people are just desperate for a solution. And they started to be more open to this concept of medication-assisted treatment. And so that was my first introduction to it. And back in 2012, Indiana brought this medication-assisted treatment specialist, or MATS, certification from Connecticut to Indiana, and I was, you know, getting some CEUs, and that was the first time I'd ever actually sat in a room with other people who worked at methadone clinics. And all of a sudden I was like, oh man, I was really ignorant about what this is all about. You know, there's so much good being done in those OTPs, or opioid treatment programs, that, you know, they've been doing wraparound services for decades. I mean, since the 60s, they've been doing all this really hard work with a really tough population and saving lives. And here I was looking down my nose at it because I didn't understand it. And so once I went through that training and kind of really took up that mantle, how I approach it and why I think it's so important is I really try to live that, meet people where they are. Mm-hmm. All the time. And one of my earliest interactions with somebody in opioid withdrawal was at that first place I worked at, and I was responsible to drive her to the emergency room, and wouldn't you know, she took off because she was in active opioid withdrawal and we weren't doing anything for it. And that was devastating to me. And you just, if you're not going to help someone through that acute withdrawal phase in a very, very strategic way, they're at really high risk of death and from an overdose. And so if I, whatever it takes to get someone invested, to get someone feeling hopeful, to get someone thinking clearly is what I'm about. And I feel like medication assisted treatment is a very viable way of doing that. Certainly not the only way. It's not for everyone, but if that's what gets their butt in the chair in my office, or we can talk about this stuff and talk about strategies and all the other things we do in therapy, then that's what I'm going to do.
I want to come back to what you said. Obviously, it makes a lot of sense meeting someone where they are, right? What do you do, though, when someone is really dead set on going abstinent-based, you know, recovery course of action for their, you know, treatment? But professionally, and perhaps ASAM might even suggest that MAT here is the really best course of action. How do you approach that conversation with the person?
So I will do whatever the client thinks will work is what I'm on board with. Now, I might be doing what I call the Columbo method, where like I know what's going to happen right in the back of my head, but that's I don't need to communicate that to the patient in that moment. So if they're like, I've got a plan, I'm like, cool, let's write this plan down. Let's talk strategy. How are we going to know it's working? How are we going to know it's not? Mm-hmm. Check back with me tomorrow. You know, whatever it takes to get you coming back, I'm with that.
Sure.
And so if they say absolutely,
yeah, you can't lose that word. You really can't. You can't lose with the patient. The patient can't lose on that either.
No. And I would rather have somebody not to try something that they didn't, that they thought would work and not work, and be able to come back to a safe space where they're not going to be judged for it.
Mm-hmm.
Than for me to go all, you know, I know what's best. So whatever they're going to do is what they're going to do anyway. So they might as well feel supported and cared about. And, you know, I may voice concerns. I may say, you know, usually what happens in my clinical space is that somebody wants to, you know, my family's pressuring me to come off of this or, and I said, well, you know, okay, if you're coming off of it, it's your goal, then that's my goal too. I will tell you that these are the indicators that someone is ready to come off. These are the indicators that somebody's maybe not so stable. So what do you think based on that? And then we go from there.
What are the different sort of, you know, mentalities, I guess would be the best word, when it comes to an abstinence-only recovery program and a MAT recovery program?
You mentioned
a couple, I think, already.
Yeah, I think there is very much I think there's less wiggle room in an abstinence-based recovery program, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, there's a lot of folks who, and by folks, I mean people who are working in the industry at abstinence-based industries where they have their opinions and they take those as facts, which is, you know, that's a whole other podcast, I'm sure. right. And so the way that I got sober or the way that these other people have gotten sober is the way that you need to get sober. And so it becomes a little bit of a cookie cutter approach and a little bit more, you know, you're either going to fall in line with what we do here or we're not
right
for you.
Right.
And I get that. You got to serve who you got to serve. And those beds, those outpatient chairs are going to be taken up by somebody who's willing to do what your program has to offer. And I think that's good. I think that, you know, the SAMHSA and NIDA and everybody else will recommend, you know, this many pathways approach to recovery.
Mm-hmm.
So if yoga is going to save you, if, you know, mountain climb is going to save you, if medication is going to save, like whatever it takes to keep you here and getting your life to where you want it to be, then I'm going to honor that. And if that means to you going to an inpatient program where you detox on your own with maybe just a little bit of comfort care and come out on the other side, then that's your choice. And I'm going to honor that.
The thing that you mentioned too, because I've heard that said as well, especially kind of coming back to your comment about the less wiggle room piece, you know, where, let's just say, I mean, I've been part of that. I've seen people do this where someone's only smoking weed now and drinking, but they're not doing opiates and they're not doing benzos. Okay. Mm-hmm. Is that still recovery?
If they call it recovery, then I'm going to call it recovery.
Sure.
Yeah. And I think that that's where, you know, I'm not a great patient either, right? So like if I'm going to go to the doctor, I've got amoxicillin in my cabinet right now that I took for a few days and didn't finish, even though that the doctor said I was supposed to finish it, right? So my level of medical compliance is malleable depending on what I'm feeling that day, just like any other human beings on the planet. Yeah. So I might be working with somebody who I can see has, you know, decades of trauma that they haven't processed. They have, you know, other medical issues. They have, you know, lots of things going on in their lives. And I can see that, you know, if they stop using substances altogether, including caffeine and nicotine, and they go to trauma focused care and do eye movement, right, EMDR, right? I can see that their life would be infinitely better and their recovery would be really enhanced. Mm-hmm. But maybe that's not what they're wanting to do right now. Right. And so if smoking some weed and not being at risk of overdose is where they're happy and that's where that's working for them, that's enough recovery for them, then sure. I'm not in a position to judge that.
Yeah, I get that.
What we do here at Franciscan, what I'm really, really proud of, is that we just try to make sure that we're always in the conversation. Hmm. So whatever you do, just tell us. You know, so right. if you're still slipping up, you're using weed, you're
that's
drinking
the hallmark of recovery right there. It's just being honest and feeling safe to be able to share this with someone.
Absolutely. And so if someone is drinking a whole bunch, I'm going to be like, yeah, that's still pretty unsafe with Suboxone. So we're going to need to keep an eye on you a little closer than we would otherwise. And so that sometimes that natural consequence of needing, you know, you'd like to be on Suboxone prescription, you know, you only have to come in once a month, but if every time you come in you've got alcohol in your drug screen, then that's not going to be safe and we're not going to be able to do that. So that, again, that seems to be as much a motivator. It's not my drug of choice, it's not my problem. Well, it's still a problem for the doctor because it's something that's going to potentially put you into respiratory arrest, so we just need to be safe with it. And that non-judgmental but direct approach, I think, is really what's required for folks.
Yeah. Well, I think that the engaging piece that, even family members can probably learn a lot from, just on how to engage one of their loved ones in where they are, you know, and opening up that dialogue so that, you know, the person who's using can feel like they can talk about this stuff. That's a huge step forward.
Yes. Yeah, no, when I first was here at Franciscan a number of years ago, we didn't have a MAP program. And so it was, you know, abstinence-based only. And part of that meant we didn't really do a lot of drug screens all that consistently. So I was just taking people's words for it. Mm-hmm. And that was nice. Like, oh, yeah, I've been clean for 90 days. And sure, great, congratulations. And so this is harder because, you know, I thought you were doing so good. And then, you know, there's a lot that, you know, you've been at this for 6 months and you're having more slip-ups. So that's in one way disheartening, and in another way incredibly hopeful because they're staying engaged so much longer.
Yeah.
You know, we've got people who have been in our program.
They're staying alive.
They're staying alive, and they keep coming back, and they keep seeing us as an ally in their recovery for 2 years after they first entered our program. You know, they've stepped down in terms of intensity and things like that, but overall they're stabilizing. And, you know, we've got some people coming back as alumni now. It's great.
Mm-hmm. Has it been challenging for you in your role to, how should I ask this? I was thinking about doctors because I used to work in a hospital setting and working with physicians, internal docs, and just in general can be challenging, right? Because doctors know a lot, and many doctors are not afraid to let you know that either. Has it been challenging to have open dialogue and conversations with doctors when you have different opinions about things?
So I mentioned that my mom's in recovery, and if anybody listening to the show remembers their family roles from the addiction family, I am firmly in the hero camp. So I am, I am more than happy to make someone feel like they are the smartest person in the room if it gets my client stable.
I gotcha. Yeah.
So, and that's going to sound far more manipulative than it really is. Like I know that they know the things. They know they went to a medical school. They've been practicing, and that's all really great. I think, and without them, you know, our clients aren't surviving. So they're a necessary and wonderful part of the treatment team. And I don't have honoring their expertise while being grounded in my own is the way that I navigate that forward. So it's not about a contest. It's not about, you know, I know more than they do, even though, you know, I think our physicians here at Franciscan, of course, have worked really hard at getting additional education and experience with addiction. So we're very lucky in that regard. But there's less training for physicians in most medical schools than, you know, someone who has a social work degree and who has additional training following getting that degree. And so it's just, they know what they know and I know what I know. And there's somewhere in the middle that we can get that client what they need.
Well, again, I don't think you can lose when you stay grounded in your own, and you're really not afraid either to talk about your own professional opinions when they've been backed up by years of experience and training, and honoring also the person that's in front of you, you know, whether that's a doctor or the person who's struggling to get off of substances. So,
well, and I think knowing my lane as well. Like I'm not going to try to, I would never dream of telling a doctor what medication to prescribe or how, or what dosage is the right dosage. I can tell them, you know, this person continues to appear like they're experiencing some withdrawal symptoms and they need to be aware of that because I'm seeing them 3 times a week in group and they're seeing them for 15 minutes every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So I have more face time with them. You know, the patient continues to experience cravings. I can tell them that. And then, you know, the doctor is going to do what they know is best in terms of treating it from the medicine side. And then if there's issues around the, you know, well, they're still testing positive for things and they need to be totally abstinent. If I go into those interactions with, you know, yes, and they are going to work and they are, you know, participating in their kids' lives and they're getting here on time. And if we don't, if this is the way that the client is choosing to self-medicate their anxiety, whether I agree with that or not, their recovery plan has to come up with anxiety reduction strategies if it's going to be successful anyway. So let's, you know, hey, you're making a choice. It's a okay choice for the moment. It's maybe not a great choice long term. How do we get you where we want to be? And again, usually every doctor, every nurse practitioner that I worked with before and here at Franciscan have all been, you know, happy with that.
Good deal. Melissa, this has been good. Just a great conversation about the different approaches to recovery, your experience, and I appreciate you coming on the show today.
Happy to be here.
Listen, if you know someone struggling with an addiction and are searching for answers, visit us at landmarkrecovery.com. to learn more about substance abuse programs that are both saving lives and empowering families. And until next week, I'm Zach Crouch with Landmark Recovery Radio.
Thank you for tuning in to Recovery Radio. New content for this program is available every Tuesday at 12 noon Eastern Time and 9 a.m. Pacific Time, with all episodes available on demand on the Voice America Health and Wellness channel and through our content partners, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play Podcasts. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review so we can continue to create quality content to help save 1 million lives in the next 100 years. You don't need to struggle through addiction alone. Live the life you dreamed on the road to recovery.